Live from Cap Radio here in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. It's early February. Yesterday was the Super Bowl, of course, and we've already had Groundhog Day. Valentine's and President's Day are still to come. The entire month of February is set aside federally as Black History Month, an annual celebration of achievements by African Americans and a time for recognizing their central role in U.S. history. The celebration started as Negro History Week back in 1926 and then expanded in 1976 to a month under President Ford. Now, many say a month just isn't enough to cover a history that dates back roughly 400 years when the first enslaved Africans were transported to what is now the U.S. In a 2005 interview, actor Morgan Freeman posed this issue this way to journalist Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes.
Black History Month, you find ridiculous.
Why?
You're going to relegate my history to a month?
Oh, come on.
What do you do with yours? Which month is White History Month? Come on. Tell me.
Well, I'm Jewish.
Okay. Which month is Jewish History Month?
There isn't one.
Oh. Why not?
Yeah.
Do you want one?
No.
No. I don't either. I don't want a Black History Month. Black history is American history.
Again, Morgan Freeman speaking with the late Mike Wallace. This morning, we're talking about African American history today, how it's taught and how intertwined it is in the larger arc of American history. And first up for this discussion is documentary filmmaker, public radio host in Baltimore, and associate professor of communication and African American studies at Loyola University, Maryland, Kay Wise Whitehead. Great to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm excited to be here. I appreciate you asking me to come and talk about Black history during this very important and very challenging time in our country.
Yeah, well, our producer Kyle had the idea and put this show together with just a great lineup of guests to really dig into this. And we wanted to start with you and your perspective, Professor Whitehead. You wrote in 2019 that you are both a supporter and critic of Black History Month. Help us understand your thoughts on the celebration.
Well, thank you for that. I want to say, just by way of full transparency, that Negro History Week, which was founded by Dr. Carter G. Woodson back in 1926, he also founded the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, which has become the Association for the Study of African-American Life and History, ASALA, which actually sets the Black History Month theme every year. I am the national secretary for ASALA and have been for the last 6 years. So I am intimately involved in choosing the Black History Month theme and in helping to guide how the country celebrates and thinks about Black history. Our theme for this year is the Black family, representation, identity, and diversity. And we set the theme a few years back, but never more than now. Particularly in the light of COVID-19 and Black Lives Matter, the Black family is ultimately important. I say that I'm both a critic and a supporter for some of the reasons that Morgan Freeman said, although I greatly disagree with Morgan Freeman. I do argue that Black history is American history and Black history is everybody's history. I also understand that in this country, as we battle against white supremacy and white privilege and whiteness, if we didn't have a month set aside to force the studying of Black history, there are places in this country, and I've been to those places out in Nebraska, Arkansas, Arizona, that wouldn't talk about Black history at all. Until we get to a point that Black history is deeply embedded into the American history curriculum, then we have to continue to focus people's efforts on the contributions of African Americans to this country. Should it be 1 month? No. And I also want to dispel the myth that it's the shortest month of the year. Everyone says, oh, we don't want Black history in the shortest month of the year. Carter G. Woodson, Dr. Carter G. Woodson, chose the second week in February because it's set between the birthday of Abraham Lincoln and the birthday of Frederick Douglass, which was already being celebrated within the Black community. So he chose that week specifically, not because it was a short month, but because there were celebrations going on within the Black community.
Professor, since you're so closely tied to the organization that sets the theme, help us understand why this year's theme of the family is so important and what you hope people will gain from it, the greater understanding of what's the focus there.
Well, what's interesting is that as I noted earlier, we set the theme a couple of years back. So we don't wait until the year before because we have a lot of things in motion. We have to get our bulletins together for the teachings for our K-12 classrooms. We deal with our posters. We talk about how we're going to lay out the year. But we have been looking at focusing on the Black family for quite a while. And given the fact that we were talking about this thing during the presidency of Donald Trump, what was really important for us was to spend some time thinking about the stereotypes around the Black families, the myths around the Black family, the importance of the Black family, the strength and the resiliency of the Black family, and wanting people to take a minute to focus on that. The reason why I said that it's just so appropriate for this year is because we're dealing with the very real impact of COVID-19 and how it's disproportionately impacting the Black family. Like the research just showed that we're losing a generation of Black mothers and fathers between the ages of 40 and 50. So the Black family this year is what we should be focused on. Mm-hmm.
How would you assess the general knowledge of African American history among your students?
I feel that there are two camps, I would say. This new camp, which is the Zillennials. These are the young people who have come of age doing Black Lives Matter. The only president that they know is Donald Trump. They were having conversations about white supremacy when they were in 10th grade. You know, they were marching out for climate control. They marched out for Black Lives Matter. They marched out for gun legislation about the shootings and killings in their schools. These Zillennials are more actively involved than any generation that I've taught. And I've only been teaching, I say 13 years, but I've taught millennials, older millennials, younger millennials, and now these Zillennials. Previously, prior to this year, I found that students were still very confused about Black history. Like they knew the big six, you know, they knew Dr. King and Rosa Parks. They knew about Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth, but they didn't know much about Booker T. Washington. They didn't know much about W.B. Du Bois or Ida B. Wells or Dorothy I. Hyde. Like they knew about Barack Obama, but that was the extent of it. The Zillennials this year, the students that I'm teaching this year, as they've been wrestling with anti-racism and really addressing their own white privilege, they are hungry for this conversation. It's not just surface level discussion. They really want to delve deep into personal responsibility and what they can do to change the reality of what whiteness looks like in this country.
What is the racial makeup in your class? Is it a required course?
No, it is not a required course. I teach in both. I straddle between communication, African and African American studies. But what I do is I make sure that every class, as we talk about history, that we talk about all histories. I also founded here at Loyola the Carson Institute for Race, Peace, and Social Justice. We launched in October of last year. It is the first institute at a Jesuit college to be named after a Black man who's not a Jesuit. It's named after my father. And so I am engaging with these conversations, and it permeates every aspect of the campus. So just a few weeks ago, I was in conversation with Dr. Ibram Kendi talking about how to be anti-racist. And in 2 weeks, I'll have Jamel Bowie from the New York Times talking about Black history, race, and representation. So because of the Institute, students don't have to be enrolled in my class to engage with these conversations. And they hear me every day on Today with Dr. K, where I openly confront these issues every day from 3 to 5 p.m. This is what we talk about.
Yeah. I just want to get some clarification on a term that you used. Did you say Zillennials?
Zillennials. So this is this generation. So you know that we have the Xers, which you might be an Xer.
I am.
We have the Millennials, which are the ones that, you know, in their 30s or so. It's the under 21 crowd. It's Generation Z. They call them Zillennials with the
Zillennials.
Z.
Okay.
Zillennials. But they're the ones that might be the generation to save us, even from ourselves, because they're just so advanced and they won't take no for an answer.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate.
So you mentioned about how because of everything that was going on around them, they were able to get so much more information. But what do you make of the actual education the students are getting, K-12, on Black history? What's being taught, not what they're getting, you know, through social media and all the other sources?
I think this is where the problem is, and this is why the push is to embed Black history into the American history curriculum. I train K through 12th grade teachers in culturally responsive instruction, and I am constantly working with them to rewrite their classroom curricula, that there has to be a way that students can understand as early as pre-K that we don't come out of the regular curriculum and then we talk about Black people and then we come out again and then we talk about women and we come out again and we talk about Hispanics or Asian Americans. But every other day when we're back in the regular curriculum, it really is focused on white history without saying it specifically, right? There is no White History Month because white history is taught from March until January until we stop for Black History Month. The schools are struggling in that area, and that is the push. And until that happens, until every single student understands that Black history is American history and everybody's history, then we have to have Black History Month. Like it gets a little co-opted, right? When you have the NFL doing, you know, Imagine Change, but we all remember Colin Kaepernick and the fact that they only have three head coaches that are Black. Like we get the reality of it, but let's use every platform to keep reminding people of why this is our history. And when I say our, I'm not talking about myself as a Black person. I'm talking about myself as an American. Mm-hmm. It is our history.
Right. It may seem obvious, you know, African-American contributions and achievements are visible throughout history. So why is Black history as American history such a tough thing to achieve?
Because of racism, oppression, white supremacy, because of the history of race relations, because of American slavery, because there was direct teaching that African Americans were less than and whites were more than. This goes back to the foundation of this country. If you start at two unequal points, then until you stop and you bring about balance and equity, then the group that starts behind will never catch up. I mean, that's what Malcolm X said. If we both start a race and I have a big steel ball tied around my leg, yeah, you shoot and say go, but you're running and I'm crawling. And so even if you take the steel chain off my leg and I start running, I'm never going to catch up to you because you're gone. So until you stop and give me a chance to catch up, and until we bring about true equity, and until we face the realization that is embedded into the foundation of this country, then we will never get to a place that people can accept it. I mean, we may have millennials who can accept it, but they live in a household with Generation Xers and baby boomers who do not accept it, right? Who are constantly speaking out some of the indifference that we see. I mean, we saw this on January 6th. You had mothers at the Capitol and daughters, you know, outing them online saying, my mother is here, won't let me go to a Black Lives Matter march. Mom, is that you storming the Capitol? So you have this push between the generations. And until we get that lined up and until we get that reconciled, I think we're always going to have this challenge. It's not just enough that we wait for boomers and Generation Xers to die off to have equality. No. It's trying to find a way to get everybody to the table to get them to realize that this country will not survive being as divided as this is. I'm not talking about being politically divided. I'm talking about racially and economically as divided as it is at this moment. And until that is dealt with, I don't think anything else can be settled.
Properly teaching this topic requires digging into some really dark and uncomfortable topics: slavery, the civil rights struggles. How do teachers handle explaining some of that extremely sensitive information?
I tell them the same way that we handled the extremely sensitive information around teaching around about Vietnam, teaching about the Great Depression and the suicides that happened with that, teaching about the Revolutionary War and the death of all of those men and women to fight to be free from British rule, teaching about the Civil War and the 670,000 people that died on this land as we fought to become one country again. It's the same type of history. Slavery is American history. I mean, it's what built the economy. As Ira Berlin said, we were not a society with slaves. We were a slave society, which meant slavery set at the center of our economic system. How do you teach capitalism without teaching about slavery? You do if you teach it as a lie. But if you teach the truth of it, you have to think about cotton as king, and beneath cotton as king, it's about Black bodies pulling the cotton that became the king. So it's not about understanding that it's something sensitive. It's American history. It's nasty. It's rough. It's emotional. It's emotional. It's messy. And I think we teach children the truth about this because if nothing else we've learned during COVID-19 is our children deserve to know the truth. that we don't lie about, hey, there's this disease that might go away tomorrow. No, put your mask on and we are fighting through this together. I think we've learned that the last thing we need to do is to lie to our children about what is happening because we're not giving them enough information to prepare them to be able to fight.
Dr. Whitehead, I'll end with this. You wrote in 2019, quote, I hold fast to the hope that one day we will not need a designated month to remind people of who we are, but that people will recognize that Black history is American history. When do you think that that day will come?
I actually thought we were much closer to that point when I first wrote that than I do now. We were in the midst of Black Lives Matter, I call it 1.0, back in 2019. We were coming off of fighting and marching, thinking about Trayvon Martin and Tamir Rice, thinking about Eric Garner, thinking about Corinne Gaines and Sandra Bland. Like, we were in the midst of all of that. And there was a sense that we were moving in a different direction. And then Donald Trump was elected. And I think the Band-Aid that was holding back the tide of racial inequality was loosed. And what we saw was pure hatred being poured out against anyone that was considered to be the other. I think if you combine that with the reality of how COVID-19 has just devastated the Black community, we are a lot farther back than I thought we were. I don't think we are anywhere close to equality. I think right now the focus is on trying to heal the nation. I'm thinking both physically from COVID-19, but also economically. I know that racial equity is on the agenda for President Biden and Vice President Harris, and that they're putting that as one of their key moments that they want to focus on. But you and I both know, until we get through COVID-19, until we get this economy back on track, everything else is secondary. And unfortunately, the secondary part of it is dealing with racial equity in this country, which is unfortunate. I wish it wasn't an either or. I just haven't seen enough to see it as an and both in terms of COVID-19. It's just so important, and it should be. Like, until we get through that, how else are we going to do anything else?
Yeah. So for the time being, Black History Month is a necessity in your mind.
Black History Month is a necessity, and I would argue that with what's happening in our country, even from the fact that Black people are getting less access to the vaccines and you have white people with privilege jumping the line, like, if nothing else, we're seeing the true face of racial inequity, economic inequity, social injustice, and it's painful and it's hard and it's messy and it's real. And I think we teach about it and we talk about it, as we will be doing for generations to come. We're going to be studying COVID-19 with the same intensity that we've been studying the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, trying to figure out, how do people get out of it? When do they make the wrong decisions? Where do they go right? And then how do we learn from their lessons? I think we're right now, we're charting a path where people will learn from what we've done wrong.
What a pleasure speaking with you, documentary filmmaker, radio host of Today with Dr. K on WEAA in Baltimore, and associate professor of communication in African and African American studies at Loyola University, Maryland. Dr. K. Wise Whitehead, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for your time, and I appreciate having the opportunity to speak with you about this. Well,
I 100% see why you have your own radio show. You're very, very good. Yes. All right. Up next, a deeper dive into the misconceptions when it comes to African-American history and how it's taught. We'll also be joined by the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles chapter. Shoot us an email if you have thoughts, insight@capradio.org, or you can always use the Twitter hashtag #AskInsight. And you are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio on this Monday. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are talking about African-American history today and how it is so entwined in the larger arc of American history that it really can't be separated. And yet it has been. Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks are perhaps the most familiar historical figures in African-American history, and they are indeed important. But there were many others, both within the civil rights movement and beyond, who have been left out of the story mostly, not just when it comes to reform movements, but their very role in the fabric of American life, including advances and achievements in medicine, education, music, literature, and on and on. African Americans are part of it all, but we reserve just a month a year to consider that history. NBA basketball superstar for the Los Angeles Lakers, LeBron James, had this to say just last week when asked by reporter Mike Trudell about Black History Month.
To keep it all real with you, Mike, Black History Month is every month. They just happen to give us the shortest month of the year, but Black History Month is all 12 months for me. You know, we celebrate Black excellence every single day. Every single day of the year, 365 days, and go around my household and around the people, a group of people I'm around. So, you know, I love the fact that we get to celebrate it for a full month, and people, you know, that may not know about it, kind of come together and things. But at the end of the day, I celebrate Black excellence every single day, and Black History Month, I would say, is Black History Day, 365 days of the year.
Again, LeBron James there. Joining us now is Assistant Professor of African American Studies, American Indian Studies, and History at UCLA, Kyle Mays. Great to have you with us, Professor.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here this morning.
Yeah, I guess I should start with your thoughts on what LeBron James said there.
I think what LeBron James was differentiating was the difference, of course, between celebrating Black History Month and the larger society celebrating that month, as well as what it means to be Black in an everyday sense, like celebrating Black excellence. And to me, LeBron is certainly giving two different versions of what it means to be Black in this country and who celebrates it every day versus who celebrates it just once a month.
Mm-hmm. Right. He did mention February being the shortest month of the year. And Dr. Whitehead, I'm not sure if you were listening, but just last segment mentioned that there was a very good reason for why it falls when it does.
Yes, I've heard this since I was a child, and I think many people in the Black community have heard such a statement. And again, it's just related to, as was mentioned earlier, between Frederick Douglass's birthday and the birthday of Abraham Lincoln. So it should happen to be a short one.
So the teaching of history to young children can be fraught with myth. You know, many know the one about George Washington and the cherry tree. Professor Mays, what are some myths that students have about Black history?
One of the, I think, favorite myths is the commodification of and reimagining of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., for instance. So there's this whole idea that Dr. King was simply a man of nonviolence, which he was. Don't get me wrong about that. But yet he also had security around him who carried guns. One of the groups, for instance, the Deacons of Defense, who were actively protecting Dr. King, and they carried guns, and they did not carry a nonviolent philosophy with them. The second thing about Dr. King, especially perhaps those who consider themselves conservatives, have considered Dr. King focusing on the content of our character. But what they forget, when he gave this speech in Washington, D.C., what they forget about that particular piece of history, he's also saying we're coming to cash our check, right? That the U.S. owed something to African-American people as well. So they sort of take that out of context. Mm-hmm. And this misremembering, I like to call it, of Dr. King is perhaps one of the most fascinating components of understanding and teaching African-American history today.
And Dr. King, of course, known for leading the civil rights movement, but in reality, he was one of many. Can you share with us some of the other people who were really big along those lines?
Sure. They're fantastic people. People like Fannie Lou Hamer, who my colleague Keisha Blaine at the University of Pittsburgh is publishing a book that will be out this year in October. Fannie Lou Hamer was a rural Black woman from Mississippi who was a leader in organizing working class people, poor Black people, and work with many white people as well, seeking justice, the Mississippi Democratic Freedom Party, for instance. So there are many folks like that, everyday people who do not get the attention or credit that they deserve as important figures in Black history.
Yeah. And then some of those stories, maybe some of the more well-known ones, or would have been well-known at the time, get lost somewhat through the translation of history?
Yes, absolutely. I think they get commodified. So what I would like to call the commodification of Black history even today. So mm-hmm. misremembering of someone like MLK, an eraser of Black women within the civil rights movement. So all these things combined, it's amazing to me that these things sort of happen well into the present.
Yeah, help us understand what you mean by commodification.
Yeah, so what I mean by commodification, so Apple has a Black history ban. Corporations have Black Lives Matter. We saw things around in the Super Bowl. Black Lives Matter is on the NBA court. And so what you have is every February, people profiting and making money off of Black pain, Black history, and Black suffering, which to me is quite unfortunate. It can be educational, but it's mostly about making money. And I don't think that's the right way to go about celebrating African-American history, mm-hmm. which is filled with pain and oppression, as well as resistance.
Yeah. California has played an integral role in Black history and the civil rights movement, to be sure. We know the Black Panthers were founded in Oakland. So what about preserving California's place in the civil rights movement, and help us understand how important California has been in this role?
California was central, especially certainly the Watts riots, et cetera, but especially, as you mentioned, the formation of the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California, also the Los Angeles chapter in, founded by Bunchy Carter, and the unfortunate murder of Black Panthers at UCLA, my home campus, in the late 1960s. So that sort of activism, armed self-defense, and imagining U.S. democracy to be different, to become better and different, similar to what Black Lives Matter has been doing today, has been a key part of African-American history, especially in places like California as well.
Mm-hmm. During this struggle for freedom, you mentioned women being erased to some degree. How important was their role in this movement?
Well, a lot of Black women, often will focus on large male leaders, figures, personalities, but we ignore that many organizations had people, especially Black women, doing most of the daily tasks. They weren't always on television, going in front of cameras. They were mailing things, putting things together, like Marion Kramer in Detroit, part of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. They were out in the streets, but they were certainly doing paperwork, the Breakfast for Children's program through the Black Panther Party. They're feeding children. So they're doing all these daily tasks, which don't get much credit, but which are essential and foundational for organizations to run.
Yeah. Professor Mays, I want to ask you this before I let you go. We're going to talk about Black nationalist and African-American leader Malcolm X a little bit later in the show. You wrote in the Washington Post just last year about how he warned us about the pitfalls of looking to Black celebrities as leaders in the movement. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so Malcolm X, at a panel he gave in 1963 at Berkeley, California, he criticized certain leaders for what he would call selling out to white liberals, he would call them. And for Malcolm, he understood that just because you have money, wealth, access to power, proximity to white elites, that does not necessarily mean that you should be even considered a leader. For him, you are selling out the Black working class, Black poor people, because you're there for your own individual interests and not for the interests of those who are less fortunate for you. So Malcolm was very keen on understanding the class divisions within the African-American community. And we see some of these things today.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could cite some examples of who might fit that role today.
Well, I think today, and people I deeply respect for instance, LeBron James and the More Than a Vote initiative, and people using phrases like using our platform. For me, the question is, what does that even mean? And who designated you as such a leader? Is it because you have a certain talent? Is it because of your proximity to white elites and politicians? For example, Ice Cube, as a more recent example, when he was trying to work with the Donald Trump administration and get around $500 million, when many reports suggest you need 15 to 21 million, I'm sorry, trillion dollars to have any significant change in the wealth gap for African-Americans. So these are more recent examples. But you have, of course, counterexamples such as Colin Kaepernick many, including Maya Moore of the WNBA.
Mm-hmm. Assistant professor of African-American studies, American Indian studies, and history at UCLA. Kyle Mays, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate the conversation.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for having me.
So we're joined now by Melina Abdullah. She's the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles chapter and is a professor of Pan-African Studies at California State University, Los Angeles. Great to have you. Welcome you into the conversation now. How are you today?
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, you bet. So in terms of turning points in history, how would you rate the Black Lives Matter movement?
Well, I'm biased, but I think that the measures that we saw this summer with Black Lives Matter being measured as the largest social and racial justice movement in global history speaks volumes.
Also, I think go ahead.
Yeah, you may have been going here. We were recently nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. People continue to come into the movement, and the movement's having tremendous impact in terms of electoral outcomes, policy work, but also the harnessing of Black power and the radical imagining of Black freedom and building kind of alternative visions of what the world should be.
Yeah, and widespread support in the U.S. I recall surveys that came out in, I think, June of last year showing like 70-80% of people showing support for the movement.
Yeah, 78% support and trust in the movement. Black Lives Matter has been measured as either the top or the second most trustworthy organization in the minds of most Americans.
Mm-hmm. So I want to get to an element of the movement with you now. You've said that the Black Lives Matter movement has been grounded in some component of spirituality. Can you expound on that just a bit and let us know what you mean specifically?
Sure. So when we talk about the struggle for Black freedom, it's really important to remember that we've often been blocked from more tangible tools, right? So when you talk about, I think about the fact that we've never submitted to our own oppression, and Black Lives Matter is really one point on the struggle for Black freedom. So when we talk about the colonization of Africa and the utilization of spirituality there, when we talk about Black people in this country under the system of chattel slavery and the way in which Mama Harriet Tubman talked about God speaking to her and really guiding her feet, right? When we talk about the anti-lynching movement and the really kind of foundational space that the Black church played in that and continued to play through the civil rights era. And when we talk about now more than ever, this principle of mutual aid, the idea that our collective resources need to be used for the benefit of all of that, that's all spiritual practice that goes into Black liberation. So Black Lives Matter is no different. We understand that literally when we're called to activate, many times it's after someone was killed by police, and we often go out in that moment, and we're often standing literally on the blood of someone whose life was stolen. And so when we gather, we do something called the pouring of libation, and we do prayer circles, and it's really spiritual work. And so That's what I mean when I say Black Lives Matter is a spiritual movement. We understand that spirituality has always been a tool used for Black freedom, and we continue to utilize that tool.
We've talked about this with the previous two guests, so I want you to weigh in on it as well, because I imagine there are as many opinions as there are people. but Black History Month, how do you see that historically, and how do you see it today?
Sure. Well, Black History Month is a demonstration of Black autonomy. It's part of the struggle for Black freedom. I know that there is kind of this mistelling of history that they gave us Black History Month. We have to remember that, no, we took Black History Month. In 1926, Dr. Carter G. Woodson visioned Negro History Week. Dr. Carter G. Woodson is one of the most brilliant minds to ever walk this planet. The son of formerly enslaved people, one who had to work in the West Virginia coal mines and drop out of school, not going back until his 20s, finally being the second Black person to earn a PhD from Harvard University, and really committing those intellectual tools that he developed to Black liberation. In 1926, he said, we need a week to focus on Black liberation, but also focus in such a way that we understand that as we struggle forward, he didn't talk about this principle, but this is really what the principle is. It's a principle of Sankofa. The idea in West Africa, there's something that's often presented as a Sankofa bird. And I'm sure everyone's seen it. It's a bird that's rendered as a bird whose feet are facing forward, but its head is craned completely backwards, and it's reaching back, and it has an egg in its mouth. And the message of Sankofa is that in order to struggle forward, we have to learn the lessons, we have to understand the history, we have to understand the teachings and the people and the spirits of the past. And that's what Dr. Carter G. Woodson was doing in 1926, but also what the students at Kent State University were doing in 1969, when they said, a week is not enough, we're taking the entire month of February. And I say they actually did more, because they started their celebration January 3rd and went through the end of February. So it's more like a Black History Months than Black History Month.
There you go. Malina Abdullah is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles and is a professor of Pan-African Studies at Cal State LA. We really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. And happy Black History Month. Still ahead, the co-author of an award-winning biography of the life of African-American leader and Black nationalist Malcolm X talks about the book and key parts of his life with our very own Cap Radio Reads host, Donna Appadoni. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. We've been talking about how Black history is American history today, how it's taught, and whether it can be taught adequately in just a month out of the year. African-American leader and Black nationalist Malcolm X, in particular, is one prominent figure in history that it can be overshadowed by the likes of Martin Luther King Jr. and others. Here's a clip of Malcolm X talking about his by any means necessary philosophy in a 1965 interview on CBC's Front Page Challenge just weeks before his assassination.
I don't in any way encourage black people to go out and initiate acts of aggression indiscriminately against whites. But I do believe that the black man in the United States and any human being anywhere is well within his right to do whatever is necessary by any means necessary to protect his life and property, especially in a country where the federal government itself has proven that it is either unable or unwilling to protect the lives and property of those human beings.
A biography was published last year titled The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X. It won a National Book Award in November. The co-authors are Les Payne, a well-known journalist in New York, and his daughter, Tamara Payne, who say it was some 30 years in the making. Les Payne died after most of the book was written, but his daughter saw the project through to publication. Cap Radio's Morning Edition and Reed's host, Donna Abedoni, recently interviewed Tamara Payne. In the biography, she and her father make the case that Malcolm X was born into his work in 1925, and that's what this excerpt from the interview we've selected is about, how events in the few years before the leader was born changed the atmosphere for African Americans in the U.S. and how his early life prepared him for his role in the black movement.
Marcus Garvey during the 1920s, you know, was very popular, even though he was taken out of the country, basically told to leave. But his parents were Garveyites, and they met Montreal, and they definitely, and Garveyism is really important because it was about black people embracing who they are, being independent thinkers, but supporting each other, building their own communities. And you gotta have to think about what America was like, even at Garvey's time, was different than what America was in 1960s, which is also different than what America is today. But so what he's preaching and things that he does, I mean, we're like, wait a minute, for example, when he's talking about his back to Africa, I remember in the '80s, people had hated hearing that about Garvey and with Cascade about that. But what he was really about was raising the image and pride of black people throughout the world. And so he did that through his movement. His movement was international. He was from Jamaica. Malcolm's parents met up actually at a Universal Negro Improvement Association meeting in Montreal. They eventually married, settled in Philadelphia, and then moved on to other parts of the United States and the Midwest, where they organized for this group. And in Omaha, Nebraska, where they land and where we open up this book is, in the incident of 1919, the race riots, which was the Red Summer of 1919, had happened. And that was this lynching. And I advise people to read that particular chapter, especially about this incident, the way it plays out, because the what went down at the Capitol could have been that. You know,
in what way? Tell us a little bit more about.
Well, because if you think about Omaha at the time, and when we talk about the Red Summer 1919, this is when the black veterans are coming back from the United States for fighting for our rights over in Europe. Right? They come back, and they fought. They served in the army. They fought for everybody's rights, and they have rights, and they want to express them. But white Americans were not, open to that. They didn't want to compete with black veterans for jobs. They didn't want them, even in buying houses, where they could live. These were, their exclusionary clause, which affected the little family when they moved to Lansing, where that said black people could not live on certain lands in the North, in the Midwest.
That was quite a bit different than these people had seen as soldiers in Europe, where there was a different kind of equality or something more like equality. Coming back home seemed very foreign to them.
When you travel abroad, coming back home often seems foreign. I have to say that.
Yeah, I guess we could just assume
but
that, huh?
It is a foreign experience coming back home when you travel, but it's important.
Yeah.
But anyway, getting back to this incident, so in Omaha, what was going on, and this particular incident had to do with a couple who were out on a date, and this woman says that she was raped by a black man in front of her boyfriend. And, many years later, they found that this was not true. but that's what she said. And so this riled everybody up. Their tensions were high. They were angry about Black people who they were competing with Black people for jobs and unions. And this was, it was hotly contested, highly tense, situation when you're dealing with the community of Omaha. And so these race relations were what they were. And they went after any Black person they could find. They found this guy who actually suffered from rheumatoid arthritis, serious. And, but he was one that ended up being lynched for this rape charge. But when you think about the reason why I say it could have happened at the Capitol, because what happens, there was a sheriff, there was a mayor, involved. They didn't want to turn over this young Black man because they want him, he should be tried. He should charge him, try him. He was arrested. The mob wanted this Black man. And anybody that stopped them from getting him, they were going to kill. They actually did hang the mayor. He did not die, but they hanged him and he had to be taken to the hospital. So that's what I mean. When we hear those stories where they set up a noose outside the Capitol and they were talking about, they were looking for Mike Pence, it's quite interesting when you think about it in that sense. And that's why this is just an example why this book is important. It shows us what was happening. This was 100 years ago. And look at what happened last week.
There are too many things that haven't changed in all of that time. Too many lessons that haven't been learned and too many things that haven't been changed. Malcolm was, that's some of the things that happened to him so early in life. He was very young when his father died. His mother was institutionalized. I mean, you start to see where a young person could be very angry.
Angry, but certainly bending under a lot of pressure on their shoulders, right? I mean, it was tough for a lot of people, but a lot of families didn't have, when his father had died and his mother is getting her widow's compensation, he has to go to the court, the judge to get it. And he's trying to get her to sign over her farm to him, and to the point where her son Wilfred has to, and these are stories we're getting from Wilfred. He has to go to the judge and the judge is trying to avoid him saying, the secretary is saying he's not here. And then he happens to walk out. Wilfred's just waiting for him. And he reluctantly gives him his mother's check. This is funds that are due her. And why? Because he's trying to get their farm from them, not buy it, literally steal it. And so these are the things that were going on. And this was in Lansing, Michigan. So we're not even talking about Jim Crow South at this point. And so this is throughout the country. And Malcolm talks about this too in his speeches. It's like, when you're talking about the South, basically if you're south of Canada, you're in the South, he said that. And but getting back even to how we opened up the story, we opened up at the Insta in Omaha, where the little family moves to Omaha, Nebraska in the 20s. This is a few years after the Omaha incident where Will Brown, who I was just talking about, where he was lynched and burned, his body was burned. And it's horrible.
And he's the man who was accused.
He was accused, who also has suffered from rheumatoid arthritis. He was accused of attacking and this woman. But that incident, it has been written about before. It's an important incident to understand that this is what was going on rampantly around the country. This kind of energy, and this energy is it's right there, right now. It's
right,
you can touch it
right in front of us.
Right. Yeah. But the family who moved to Omaha a couple of years after this, they're still feeling reverberations from that. Malcolm's father is organizing families. He's regional head of the UNIA, Marcus Garvey's organization. He's like a UNIA chapter president, and he is organizing, families miles away. And the local chapter of the Klan comes to visit them, the family, the little family. And they want, to intimidate them. They call for Earl Little to come out. He's not home. And Louise Little, who is pregnant with Malcolm and has three other children, is there. And she stands her ground. She protects her family. She doesn't, you know, bow to the threats of these Klansmen. But they basically tell her, you know, before they leave, and they break her windows, to get out of town, because they are not happy with that, what they're doing, you know, in organizing families. And so this is how we open the book. And Malcolm's in utero. He is not even born yet, but this is the world he's born into. So it's important to understand that, you know, it's not, we present, you know, a more nuanced version of Malcolm and looking through his family. But it's also the world he's born into and the world that still exists.
All right. Co-author of the 2020 award-winning biography, The Dead Are Rising, The Life of Malcolm X, Tamara Payne, speaking with Cap Radio's Morning Edition and Reads host, Donna Appadoni. The Cap Radio Reads podcast version of that interview, which is much longer, will be posted soon. So be on the lookout for that at capradio.org. And I'm Randall White. That's Insight for today. We'll catch you back here tomorrow morning.